to the 8th episode of Reverse Rep Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
Welcome to the podcast with all the accuracy of a Jimi Anderson death spell. As you've probably noticed if you've listened before, we do take our preparation very seriously. So frankly, we didn't take kindly to Ireland's attempt to ruin it today.
We were feeling slightly out of kilter.
Well, we discussed this yesterday.
As I think it's been most of the cricket world.
We had today's game down as sort of interesting, but still very much an England canter.
Well, I don't know about you, but I had 150 quid on Ireland's winner. So
really?
With Kevin O'Brien being the quickest ever World Cup centurion.
And that's probably not just drinks on Toby, that's probably a small flat in South Kensington
exactly.
on Toby. But we'll move on to talk about all things World Cup. Rather appropriately, we're going to start thinking at a time when the associates are not going to be playing a part in future World Cups. Which of the associates have done their cause proud over the last few weeks? And I think we have an obvious answer now, don't we?
It's hardly difficult to choose. And it's lucky, really, that I chose Ireland in advance. because, this has been a remarkable... Today's events have been remarkable, not only because Ireland have beaten England. That was bound to happen at some point anyway, and Ireland have beaten Test Nations before in one-day internationals. But the fact that they chased 327 to win the biggest ever World Cup, the World Cup chase, is indicative of a side with bags of ability, even if it only does come out at
times. Well, we were discussing beforehand, how does this compare to their victory over Pakistan in the Caribbean? And you can't help feeling that it trumps it. I mean, Pakistan, in a way, made life easy for Ireland. They crumbled to 132 all out in that game. And Ireland, frankly, didn't even chase that score particularly convincingly. They got there with about three wickets left. I mean, this score looked completely beyond them.
And even though England had two or three opportunities, one of which halfway through their own innings when Bell and Trott were going very well, and one of which was in the middle of the Ireland innings to put this game to bed, it wasn't entirely England's fault that Ireland won. It wasn't simply a case of England cocking the whole thing up.
Yeah.
Ireland did play very, very well at periods of the game.
And in terms of doing the associates proud, I mean, you had to feel the associates needed a victory at some point in this tournament. They needed to get one over at least one of the test sides, and they've got that.
And have been flying the flag for that.
Yeah. Well, I kind of pulled the short straw on this one. Before today's events, decided that it was, in fact, the Netherlands who'd been the standout associate side of the tournament so far. I still think you can make a case of sorts for this. I mean, let's remember that going into the tournament, I think Netherlands, of all the associate teams, very low reputation, really certainly lower than the Irish. And, I mean, England's opening game was really supposed to be a comfortable, comfortable canter. And it turned into a real sort
and
of
almost a repeat of that Lords World 2020
well,
final.
It was very close, and I thought for me the image that I'll remember that game is Peter Boren, the Dutch captain at the end, looked mortified not to have won it.
You know,
he looked genuinely shocked not to have won it. And Ryan Tedder Starcher, whose name I've made
several passes
on. He
hasn't got much starch in him, I don't think.
No, he... we'll leave that. But he...
Ryan
has made... I mean, he's made a very compelling case to be taken seriously as a sort of world-class player. You can't help feeling there's a trend here. England making associates feel good about themselves.
It's our benevolent nature.
Our benevolent...
Well, I suppose one of the reasons that the associates are being stripped out of the World Cup is because of... it's a month today until the World Cup final, and we've still got another 3 weeks of the group stages to go. And these particularly long group stages are being cut down by taking associates out of the equation. What do you think this year has been the match that's most contributed to the tedium of the opening weeks?
Yeah, I mean, we were certainly expecting tedium, weren't we, in this never-ending group stage. For me, the game that sort of summed it up so far, and the game that in a way has made the best case for getting rid of associates, was Canada's opening weekend clash against Sri Lanka. Mm. This game, Sri Lanka cruised to 300 odd, and it was a gentle net practice, yep. No more. I mean, you had Jaiwon and Dilshan and Sankara out there. Just it was gentle accumulation against and very low level bowling. And Canada came in and were rapidly routed. I mean, they struggled on for about 35, 36 overs. But what made this affair so miserable, I think, is that you had 80 odd overs of cricket, and it was never a contest, at any moment.
Well, interestingly, I've got a list of all of the matches that have so far been played, 15 of them. And of the results that you wouldn't have bet quite a lot of money on going in one direction beforehand, only three have actually been unexpected. Sri Lanka, Pakistan yeah. Losing Sri Lanka. The India-England draw was quite unexpected. And then, of course, the England-Ireland game today. And interestingly, two of those were actually not between an associate and a test-playing nation. And so, really, the interest hasn't been captured at all by the presence of the associates in this.
No, and I think you can't help feeling, and we'll be talking about this a little bit later, but, I mean, what benefit does it really do Canada, a game like that? And you can't, and I mean, Kenya, you could easily have chosen, I mean, Kenya have been on the back of some pretty humiliating results, but this really was, it was a pointless farce, and on the opening weekend of the tournament, when you really want to be grabbing people's interests, it was really very seriously tedious.
A game which I, moving away from the associates actually, which I sort of thought failed to live up to its expectations, was the Australia-New Zealand clash, when Australia played very well, particularly when they were bowling. Mitchell Johnson taking 4 for 33 off his 9 overs. But New Zealand never really looked as if they had the stomach for the fight at all. They sort of just rolled over.
You really fancied a bit of bite to. You've got that sort of Antipodean rivalry. New Zealand, they've been off the ball for a while now, but, traditionally competitive at World Cups, competitive in the format, and, it was one-sided,
it was that sad old formula of Daniel Vittori scoring 44 at number 9, and that being their second highest score.
Because it looked like it could be much worse, didn't it? They scraped their way to... Did they get to 200?
They 206 they got to in the end. But actually, it was numbers 8 and 9 who scored over 100 runs, nearly 100 runs between them. So, and it was just... You thought this could be a great showcase for one-day cricket, a lot of hard-hitting. And actually, some of the... As we've said in previous episodes, some of the New Zealand batting looks very promising. But it just looked as if they just didn't.
I mean,
do you think there was any case?
Because the group stages desperately needed the big teams, the clashes between the big teams to be good. I mean, was there any case for saying after the earthquake? I mean, would that have been setting a strange precedent if you'd maybe a postponement of the game?
I don't see why you would, really.
Yeah, it's a difficult one. The excuse has been made sort of in hindsight. Were they quite there? Were they quite focused on it? But it's a difficult precedent to set. I mean, moving sort of on from the games of the tournament, well, the anti-games of the tournament, the damp squibs of the tournament
non-match.
So far. What about, we were a couple of weeks in, which players are making the early case to be the players of the tournament? There have been a few standout performances so far.
There have. I've been very impressed by Pakistan in general and by Shahid Afridi in particular. Having roundly slated them in the World Cup preview episode, I thought that Afridi came out and bowled. He bowled very well against Kenya. There's always the accusation of, does that really count for anything against a side like Kenya? But then when he came out, and he was essentially the difference between Pakistan
he
and
turned
and
that
Sri Lanka.
Game. I mean, his bowling spell, when he came on, the game was very evenly poised, and his spell turned the game. I mean.
And more than that, as a captain, and Pakistan's captaincy was well-documented, but as a captain, he seems to be very much the heart and soul of the team.
And it's interesting, isn't it, because his track record when he was test captain of actually apparently getting bored of the job and walking out on them. This seems to matter to him, this World Cup. It really does. I mean, his energy in the field is something quite special.
Who's been impressing you?
Well, I'm going to go for a player who, and I'm not just doing this out of a sort of smug sense of being right, but I'm going to go for a player who I tipped before the tournament, Darren Bravo. The West Indies, frankly, haven't got a huge amount to smile about. But in their opening game against South Africa, Bravo played an innings which was just astonishing from a 22-year-old. I mean, I think the South African seam attack has it all. I mean, Morkel and Steyn are a great combo. And he attacked with sheer confidence. I mean, it's become a journalistic cliche already that he is the new Lara. He looks the part. The moment that will stand out for me, a one-handed slog over long off that was just staggering to watch.
Do you think that there's something, a little bit of desperation in there? In innings like his, because I mean, it wasn't a game-changing innings.
Well, do you think
put the pressure of a tight run chase on him when he can't, you know, he can't, if he gets out, it's disaster for the side. Do you think he's succeed then?
It's interesting. Yeah, he's fighting a sort of lone role in a desperate cause. But I think what I liked is that after he got out, he looked genuinely mortified. He looked absolutely gutted, and he'd made 70 odd. He played really well, but I think that's honestly the kind of that's been lacking from West Indian cricket. There's been a resignation to failure, and he looked devastated at the end of that. He wanted to go on and play the match winning innings. He wanted to play 100. And there was a lovely moment when Tony Kozier, doing the commentary, said he's got the potential to be a great player. Maybe he already is one. I mean, he's 22 and he's showing all the attributes.
So that's the parts of the World Cup that have been there. Still a lot to come. What are you looking forward to?
Well, I mean, I think in terms of kind of the game to watch that's left, I think what brings sort of spice to a game is that kind of knockout element, you know, is this decisive of the team's future. And I think Bangladesh's clash against West Indies at the end of this week has that. Yep. I think it's pretty much becomes a straight out shoot-off between the two sides. That being said, England's defeat today has slightly mixed that up.
But it does make it very interesting because whichever out of West Indies or Bangladesh, I don't know off the top of my head, and in fact I've got the fixtures here, but they'll both, whichever one of them loses, they're going to have to beat one of the big sides. So Bangladesh have either got to beat England, the Netherlands, well, we take that as a given. But
these are two teams just desperate to be taken seriously for different ways. I mean, Bangladesh have been hammered with criticism. You know, invited to the test game too early is now the accepted line. They've been humiliated again and again, haven't progressed quickly. West Indies, in contrast, there's a real sense amongst a lot of people, do they even deserve to be considered a top nation anymore? You know, they've been so both of these teams are desperate for a win. And I think the ramifications of a loss for both would be huge. I mean, I think if Bangladesh go out in the group stages of their home World Cup, where does it leave them? Where does it leave Darren Sammy and new coach Otis Gibson if the West Indies can't make it through? Big game, like a lot on the line.
Yeah,
what about yourself? What will you be settling down to?
So that's a basement battle.
Basement battle indeed.
I've gone rather more towards probably the top of the group in Sri Lanka, Australia. Both of whom have actually still got a lot of questions over them. Well, Australia did come into the tournament anyway, but Sri Lanka, having lost to Pakistan, if they want to get the best draw in the quarterfinals, they need to win as many matches as they can going forward. And I think it's just going to be fascinating because both of them are yet really to kick off their campaigns in any real style.
And you sort of feel both these sides, I think India and South Africa of the early sides have made the strongest impressions. You feel both these sides fit into that next down category, don't you? Of teams who you could take seriously. I'm personally thrilled by the prospect of that Australian pace attack having a go at that trio of Joe Woodney, Dilshan and Sankar. I think that's a really intriguing matchup.
And because I think it's going to be such a battle, I think we can say that whichever team comes out on top is going to have you know, going to be making a really significant step.
Is it too much to ask you for a bold prediction
in that game? I think
in that game?
I think Sri Lanka on form and home advantage are probably going to squeeze it.
Probably going to get home.
Would you say anything different?
I think they are under a lot of pressure actually after losing that Pakistan game, and I would like to say they would respond to that.
I do, as you say, there's a question of the soft underbelly of their middle order against Mitchell Johnson and the like. So, from the archives, and this week, attacks by World Cup fever. We're going to go back to 1983 and feature the first ever one-day match that we've featured in this podcast.
That's right. The third World Cup final, and we've got India up against the West Indies. I mean, in total contrast to what we have now, I suppose, in 2011, we have India very much as the underdogs, West Indies very much as the favourites.
In fact, when we were preparing for this podcast, Andy was muttering about the fact that the West Indies looked increasingly likely to win, and he used the immortal phrase "meh" when talking about India. So
and that
but we go back a few years, and it was a bit like that,
and it was something like that. And I think we've had an India team coming into this tournament the last couple of years. They've not been the total minnows of the one-day game. They've won about as many games as they've lost. But, you know, to give you an idea, earlier in 83, they've been beaten comfortably by Pakistan. They've gone to the West Indies and lost that series relatively comfortably. They're underdogs in this tournament. West Indies, in contrast, very strong side. They've been fairly dominant in the one-day format for a while, losing very few games. Look at it in 1983. A couple of defeats in Australia is pretty much it. However, it must be said, looking at this final, West Indies' first game of the tournament in the groups, they were turned over by India. So you've got that as a start, and Toby will take over the story there.
So it's a cloudy day at Lord's, and Clive Lloyd wins the toss and elects to put India in on a wicket that he thinks is going to do a little
which
bit.
Which, when you have holding Marshall and Garner, is a very
exactly.
Easy
he thinks
to make.
The wicket's going to move a little bit. There's a little bit of cloud cover, and so in go India, and essentially they don't do very well. And in 60 overs, they get to 183 all out, and there's a classic innings played by Armanath, who in fact is. Ends up being the man of the match. He scores 26 off 80 balls, and it doesn't sound much, but it's really the glue
now,
around
which. Now, if you played that in 2011, it's hard to imagine an 80 ball 26 being described as a man of the match innings.
Mm. But at the stage they were at, and considering what came later on in the innings when no one scored above 27, although actually he did only score 26, but to be able to stabilise like that and to stay in and bat out time, which is particularly important when you've got 60 overs as opposed to 50 overs, which is actually quite a different game. So the Indians score 183. The wickets are quite well spread around the. Around the West Indian seamers. And
now, at this stage in the game, at this break, I mean, how you feel...
It looks ominous.
And even in this context...
It's a routine run chase.
Exactly. And even in the context of sort of lower scoring speeds than today, this is still looking straightforward
exactly.
For a team with the West Indian strength.
And even after Gordon Greenidge pads up to a straight one and is bold, you still think that the West Indies are on course. I mean, indeed, they put on another 50 runs for the first wicket. But then there's a great moment when Kapil Dev, the Indian captain, takes a great catch to dismiss Viv Richards after Sir Vivian has looked very ominous and scored 33 off 28. And then after that, it's the Indian medium pacers who really come in and squeeze the runs out of this team of who are essentially quite big hitters, and simply by squeezing that run rate, they manage to never let West
because
Indies
you have
get
a lot
of
West
game.
Indian players there who would look pretty at home in the sort of big hitting format of that it is
yep.
today, wouldn't you? You know, a lot of players there who would be very comfortable in that.
Exactly, and eventually the West Indies get to 140. Off their 52 overs before they're all out, which is on a pitch that wasn't really doing much and with a fairly routine run chase in hand is quite a remarkable victory for the Indians.
I mean, I think perhaps this has sort of just come to me. I mean, it's almost like if we look at where these two teams find themselves in 2011, you could almost say India then was sort of where the West Indies are now, and India now are sort of where the West India now are sort of are where the West Indies then. It's
yep.
that kind of scale
yep.
of a shock.
Yep.
And I mean, in terms of long-term consequences of the game, you know, this was a big result, wasn't it? Given where we find ourselves now,
it was the World Cup was becoming increasingly popular in the 80s, and it did a lot to raise the profile of cricket in India.
And we should, I mean, this idea that you once you start becoming good at something, you sort of start liking it more. And I mean, this was a hugely high-profile success for India and a side like that. It was a very different sort of game, wasn't it, as compared to what we sort of now expect from an ODI match?
It was, and what it actually showed, a little bit like It's going to sound like a ludicrous comparison, but
I'll
run with
eagerly.
It. But even like the England India match the other day, which was very high scoring, but the excitement wasn't really from the fact that it was particularly high scoring. It was because the match had so many twists and turns and nuances in it that you never quite knew where it was going to go. And the fact that there were only, you know, just over 300 runs scored in this match didn't really matter. Nor did the fact that neither of the teams actually batted out.
And runs were hard earned here, weren't they? I mean, they were scrapped for, and they were hard earned and sort of carefully compiled.
And actually, just like you know, Tim Bresnan's fifer against the Indians, miserly fifer. It was actually the quite small but significant contributions that, you know, it wasn't the great blazing innings that changed this match. It was the small things like Armanus 26 off 80 balls to sort of steady that Indian ship in the first innings.
To the book review, and this time we'll be looking at Neville Cardus, widely seen as the cricket writer, his collection Cardus on Cricket. I was left pretty astonished very early on in this book by a piece on the 1882, that classic test between England and Australia, the one that really founded the Ashes. I was in a state of confusion pretty early on here, mainly because I was pretty sure Cardus wasn't alive during this. So I was thinking...
So when he falls asleep at Lord's and then wakes up and is there?
I was somewhat bemused. I was like, I'm early on in the book and I'm not entirely sure what's going on. And to explain to you, if you haven't read it, he goes to watch... This is sort of in the 1930s.
30s,
he goes to watch the Australians bat at Lord's and he falls asleep on a park bench and he finds himself dreaming of being at that 1882 test. And he gives a vivid description involving a parson with an encyclopedic knowledge of cricket statistics. It's fantastic stuff. And you just think, I'm very early on to the book, and you think, a guy of such a bold imagination to be picturing this old game, a game that he was never at, a game he's read scorecards and descriptions of, picturing it in such detail. I mean, tell us a little bit about the man we're dealing with.
Well, I think that's one of the key things about him, his ability to picture things and the ability to recreate. And I think that comes primarily from the fact that he was a writer more than anything else. And he was a writer before he was really interested in cricket, full stop, which is very different, obviously, from nowadays, where most of the commentators and writers about cricket are ex-cricketers. He was born and brought up in Manchester, and he actually started off life as a classical music critic. And legend has it that... one day while he was ill, and in order to convalesce, he was working for the Manchester Guardian, now The Guardian, and to convalesce, his editor sent him to a cricket match and said, look, just go to this match and write about it. And it was there that he really fell in love with the game. And he went through a number of different posts, but he remained the classical music and cricket critic, it's always a difficult one to say, for The Guardian for many years, and has been renowned for both.
And I mean, I think it makes a lot of sense, that backstory, because he is really an artist or an art critic turned cricket lover. You can see that in his writing. I mean, you can pick so many pieces in here. I mean, this is a review, but it's as much sort of singing the guy's praises aside.
Well, it's all you can do. It's all you can.
And I mean, I was so astonished by a piece on Tom Richardson. Just to read out a little moment on this, the bowler Tom Richardson. His bowling was wonderful because into it went the very life force of the man, the triumphant energy that made him in heyday seem one of nature's announcements of the joy of life. Cricketers like Richardson ought never to know of old age. Every springtime ought to find them newborn, like the green world they live in. Now, you read that, and you can't help thinking, if someone attempted that today, we'd think, God, how pretentious, how over the top.
Yep.
But it's so right at the same time. It's so bold and it's so poetic.
And I think what's particularly significant about that is that what it represents is a view of cricket which is profoundly aesthetic. And as you say, seeing it as an art form. And what's, there's a lovely essay he writes about the umpire, which should be an impossible essays right nowadays simply because the place of the umpire has changed so significantly. But he describes the umpire as the law of cricket personified, image of the noble constitution of the best of games. And he talks about the umpire as being a part of that human artistic side of the game. And, you know, the idea to him of having an umpire as computer is unthinkable, not because of any sort of moralistic reason about, you know, decision-making better or worse, but simply because for him, cricket was a profoundly human game and it was a profoundly artistic game, and that's where its beauty lay.
And I mean, this is we're talking about Carders, but I can't help, you look at the journalism of today and you wonder that it's a shame people maybe aren't as bold with their language. Mm. I mean, he saw the game as, you know, overtly as an art, and he described it in that way, sort of in that sort of poetic sense, and did so well. I mean, my feeling is that perhaps his true genius comes in the fact that he could do that and also be a true obsessive about the game. Mm. You know, those tiny little details. I mean,
see, it's quite scientifically and quite technically too.
Well, exactly, and it's his ability to combine both. You know, to see it artistically, see it aesthetically, and see it as very much a sort of technical pursuit. I mean, he writes a couple of pages on watching Jack Hobbs bat in the nets. Mm. I mean, this is something that I think most journalists today would probably cast a line on, and I don't necessarily think it's their fault. I think it's what's demanded in the papers today. I think it's what we expect to see in the papers today. We perhaps expect, I don't know, we expect pieces that are more kind of, you know, that sort of excite us because they sort of, you know, criticise someone. So, but he
revels rather than necessarily setting. I mean, it's as you say, it's a different form of journalism because it's not something that's supposed to critique. It's something that's supposed to appreciate.
Yeah, and I don't want to get dragged into sort of that. And there are some wonderful cricket writers around today. I mean, we were talking about Gideon Hay in the last episode. But you can't have a feeling that the freedom he had to write. I mean, getting back to this Hobbs piece before I get far too off the topic. I mean, he talks with utter detail of his foot movement, the precise position of Hobbs's hands on the bat. And there's this lovely line, we sometimes get a peep that takes us deeper into the mind of the character of an artist than his finished work permits. He's talking about how in practice you see something in a player that maybe you don't see when he's out in the middle. I mean, that shows a real love and a real appreciation. He also really senses the development of the game. I mean, he saw a player like Hobbs as having learnt from all the batsmen of the past. He could see a progression in the way cricket was played.
And actually, that wider context of the game is, I was quite, an essay I hadn't actually come across before. I've read quite a lot of Carders, and an essay on Bodyline that he wrote, which is called The Digression on Larwood, which is the last essay in the book, in which he puts rather an interesting spin on the whole Bodyline episode, and he talks about the fact that of there always having been, as he puts it, savages rushing into the drawing room, and, you know, sort of obsessing the status quo, and he cites Arthur Carr, the Nottinghamshire captain who famously drove around drunk and once actually drove his car into a bar after a game to demand a drink in Duncan Thrift's new book on Larwood.
I mean, that tends to be fairly effective as a method, I think,
it does, of attaching the bartender's attention. But what he does is, as he sees Bodyline in a new light, which is an odd way to say from someone writing in the late 1930s. But he talks about it as essentially a movement which was, well, just that. It was a tactic designed to overcome Bradman. And what he points out, and I think it's actually very pertinent, is that Larwood wasn't trying to change the face of the game permanently. And what Carder says is that a race of Larwoods would have wrecked cricket, no doubt, but by the measure of genius which is employed by the amoral gods, Larwood's deeds in Australia were wonderful. And he takes up a line which is actually reflected by Jack Fingleton, who of course played in the Bodyline series and went on to become a commentator, which is that the pity about Bodyline was that the reaction to it actually destroyed fast bowling for a long time afterwards, and made, you know, there was a famous West Indies tour, so England quite soon afterwards when the West Indies
and the concern
were accused of bowling Bodyline as well.
I mean, I think we've scarcely done him justice, but I think the point is, even in those discussion of a couple of his essays, wherever he ranges, wherever his attention falls, he says something coherent, and he says it so well. And I mean, he sets, frankly, a challenge out to anyone who attempts to write on the game since.
So, from the blogs, which is a title you might not recognise, that's because it used to be from the papers, but we've decided to celebrate specifically the great blogosphere that exists around the beautiful game.
The fantastic cricket blogosphere that exists.
And I'm going to kick off with one of the best, King Cricket, and a very short little article, well, really a sort of a set of observations that were written around the recent rather wonderful game between England and India. Which just, more than anything, just made a few interesting observations. Some of them have been rehearsed elsewhere. The fact that Tim Bresnan taking 5 for 48 in a game when 338 plays 338 is a pretty phenomenal achievement.
Because they're as good as they are. I mean, they're good as they are, context, but
in a game where they're nearly 700 runs, it becomes absolutely astounding. And similarly, Zaya Khan's power play spell being particularly important. The other thing which quite pleased me as a frequent abuser of the razzmatazz that goes along with quite a lot of one day in 2020 cricket was the fact that Andrew Strauss built an innings on quite a lot of fours. None of them felt like the kind of thing that you want to, you know, wave a four placard about. None of them were massive, but each one of them was important.
And he played to his strengths, didn't he, as well? You know, anything that wide of off, that sort of cuts or drives or off drives that look a lot like cut shots.
Exactly. But the point was that as with the whole game, he built an innings, and that was what was exciting, what was impressive, and it wasn't simply the fact that there were 76 fours in the whole match that made it worth watching. It was the fact that it was a close encounter, closely fought with twists and turns all the way through it,
and made it compelling. I've been looking at the old Batsman blog, which I think is always worth a read, and this week a particularly interesting piece just on the idea of coaching, really. And I think actually this is sort of underwritten about as a topic, you know, coaching, how it's evolved, how it worked. And there's a really nice comparison between actually two golf coaches here. This links slightly tenuously perhaps into the game of cricket, but there you go. John Jacobs, a golf coach who's been playing, coaching people at the highest level in golf for a while. And he particularly, his focus is that you can learn anything you want to know about a player's technique, about the impact, the moment of impact when the club strikes the ball. And the old batsman,
it's wonderfully simple, isn't it?
Well, that
idea that the only thing that matters is the moment at which the bat hits the ball and the club hits the golf ball.
This is the point that the article really makes, I think, very succinctly, is that in an era where we complicate beyond everything, you know, in terms of cricket, we statistically analyse the crap out of everything, we have very precise computer models going on, and to actually say we can pin it down on that moment, and it works for cricket as well. You know, we look at a shot and we look at that moment of impact, and we can deduce so much from that, and that's what a master coach could do. Yep. And there's this rather excellent comparison with Sean Foley, Tiger Woods' new coach, who in his opening interview with the press quotes Gandhi, quotes Aristotle, and the old batsman sort of makes the point that, you know which one you'd be happier dealing with. And in an era with, you know, where talk has overtaken so much in cricket, where, you know, talking about sort of the philosophy behind the game, you know, keeping it simple, keeping it stuck in the technical side.
So you'd want Neville Cardos observing, but not coaching, perhaps?
Well, perhaps. And I think this sort of over complicating the game, perhaps, isn't the way to maybe coach it. It might, in some circumstances, be an interesting way to write about it, but is it always the way to coach it?
On a completely different note, maybe we should just finish with another good aspect of the of blogs in general, which is that they pick up on things that you might otherwise miss. And I think we can just finish with this quotation from Ravi Shastri in the game between India and England, when he said, "India are a very strong side, but if they do have one weakness, it's their bowling and their fielding."
Right, the debate for this podcast, and you can never accuse us of not sort of going with the times, this week's topic, Ireland should be made a test nation without delay. And I'm going to be arguing for that, and not just on the basis of one fantastic victory. I mean, firstly, test cricket needs to expand. We've got perhaps slightly into a comfort zone with the nations that are there, and we're perhaps feeling like with Bangladesh we've done enough. But if the game's to be shown to be vibrant, if it's shown to be, you know, accepting. We've got to look to bring new members in. And Ireland are the standout candidate. They've proven themselves consistently as far superior to the other associates in the four-day format, and they've shown now more than once that they can mix it with the test nations on the one-day format, and they, you know, they'd be an exciting addition, I think, to the test arena. Toby, disagree with me.
I'm going to argue the opposite case and say that essentially, if you were to put to make Ireland a test playing nation, you would be doing so on the strength of one day internationals. I mean, I don't think you can say that playing 4 day matches on the second tier qualified you to become a test nation. Otherwise, why didn't you make Surrey a test nation? I agree it's a slightly disingenuous argument, but I think the point I'm trying to get at is that one day internationals are absolutely no indication of the worthiness of a test team, and you know, the technical reasons for that everyone knows, but the likelihood of Ireland ever beating England at a test match is almost inconceivable. And what I would worry about, particularly if you were to make Ireland the test team, is the increasing development of what is essentially a two-tier test structure, with Bangladesh, Ireland, the West Indies, and possibly Pakistan on the
second tier, and New Zealand
on the second tier, and then a top tier. And I just think that the more you weigh down the bottom of the test table with lesser test sides, sort of making up the numbers, the more arbitrary the test calendar becomes. And I think actually one thing that's bad for test cricket is to have too many. If India were to play Ireland in a five test series, it's going to be carnage. It's not going to be interesting.
Well, perhaps,
I'm sorry.
Perhaps there are a couple of questions here. I mean, one of which is on the basis of the speed. I think we're basically asking the question, how quickly should an associate be made a test nation, and how much should they have to prove beforehand?
Yep.
What I would argue is that Ireland can only beat what's been put in front of them. And in terms of the associate four-day game, with the exception of actually a couple of interesting games against Afghanistan, who I think we can give a lot of credit to as a side. I don't think they're there yet. But they've been very dominant, Ireland, in the four-day game at the associate level. They haven't had the opportunity to try themselves.
I would argue perhaps...
If we are looking for a transition period, if we want to do something a little bit different to perhaps with what we did with Bangladesh, maybe give them an opportunity in some domestic four-day competitions. Give them the opportunity
to prove themselves. You were arguing for, quotes, Ireland should be made a test nation without delay.
Well, I mean, I think...
without wanting to...
Let's say a short delay. But I agree
that giving them experience against some of the best four-day sides would be some of the best county or even state sides down under would be a good way to test it.
Because I think we said, like, when we're talking about Ireland, but actually we're talking about any associate, really. Ireland are the example at the moment, but any associate who aspires to test cricket, and we're talking about what they need to do to prove themselves. I think your point about a two-tier division in test cricket is very valid. The only thing I would say, I think it's happening already. I mean, I think there's no question that informally there does seem to be some sort of a break on
that. Absolutely.
You know, the big teams simply aren't interested in playing five test series anymore against the smaller sides. They don't see the point. And I think maybe that's a separate issue entirely. Maybe we do need to get concerned and worried about that. But I think perhaps if we look at Ireland coming into the game, maybe they do need to come into the test game. Maybe they do need to sort of earn their spurs with some games against the weaker sides first. And there's perhaps not a bad thing about that.
So after that happy journey through England's woes, India's victories and the joys of Neville Carlos, it's goodbye for another fortnight.